and welcome back to New Books in Intellectual History. I'm your host, Todd Weir. Christianity and socialism go together like fire and water. This was a remark made by August Bebel in 1874, when he was an up-and-coming leader of Germany's socialist movement. The anti-clerical violence of revolutions in the early 20th century, let's think of Mexico, Russia, or Spain, appears to confirm his verdict. Yet, not everyone in interwar Europe accepted the incompatibility of religion and socialism. As we learn today in an interview with the political theorist and professor at Queen's University Belfast, Vincent Gagin. The dynamism of Stalinist Russia in the early 1930s sent shockwaves through Depression-era Britain, leading a group of intellectuals to rethink their Christianity. In his new book, Socialism and Religion, Roads to Commonwealth, which has recently been reissued as a paperback by Routledge, Gagin explores the efforts of four intellectuals to fuse the two, socialism and religion, in theory, and in the form of a short-lived political party called Commonwealth, which existed at the end of the Second World War. Our conversation begins with the pivotal theorist in Commonwealth, the Scottish philosopher John McMurray. McMurray saw in communism a continuation of the ethical project of Christianity, and he interpreted communist anti-clericalism as a correction to the Christian churches who had lost sight of this project. Of his own earlier Protestantism, he wrote in 1934, "That faith today is in rags and tatters. I should rather go naked than be seen in it." Socialism had become his new form of Christian faith. Our interview ends with the contemplation of the relevance of Commonwealth for today's theoretical debates about post-secularism. One side that we live in a post-secular age today is that even left-of-center statesmen, such as Barack Obama or Tony Blair, publicly identify religious faith as a starting point for their own political and ethical commitments. To explain his own views, Blair told the Labour Party in 1994, "If you really want to understand what I'm all about, you have to take a look at a guy called John McMurray. It's all there." So please join me in the following interview, as we indeed take a look at John McMurray and the other figures of Commonwealth. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Intellectual History. I'm Todd Weir, the host of this channel. Today I have the pleasure of speaking to Vincent Gagin, who is professor of political theory at Queen's University in Belfast. And today we're going to be talking about his new book, Socialism and Religion, Roads to Commonwealth. So, Vince, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Todd.
I would like to just start off with a sort of general question. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about yourself. You know, what interest led you to this project?
Okay, well, I studied politics and history as an undergraduate at Newcastle University in England. And then I pursued a PhD at Newcastle on the thought of Herbert Marcuse, particularly looking at his concept of revolution. And that led to my first book, which was a little study of Marcuse called Reason and Eros, The Social Theory of Herbert Marcuse. I guess one of the things that attracted me to Marcuse was, if you like, the visionary dimension in his work. The category fantasy is important in his work. And that led me to develop something I'd already been interested in, which was the concept of the utopian. So I pursued that, and the fruit of that was a book in 1987 called Utopianism and Marxism, which looked at this rather sort of fractious history, the fractious relationship between Marxism and utopianism. And I tried to sort of in that book to sort of show, on the one hand, rather complicated relationship, and also wanted, in a sense, to defend the category of the utopian. And then pursuing this sort of interest in the utopian, in 1996, I think it was, I published a book on what to me, or still is to me, one of the most significant attempts to combine utopianism and Marxism. And that was Ernst Bloch. Partly the book was to speak to a sort of Anglophone audience in the wake of the translation of The Principle of Hope into English, trying to show, you know, what was valuable in Bloch's analysis. And one of the things which I found particularly interesting in his work was the analysis of religion. And in the late 90s, I began to think more and more about the relationship between like religion, social theory, secularism, and so forth. And began to think in terms of the concept of the post-secular, which in the late 90s was relatively little used. And it's this, in a sense, which provides the context for the book, my latest book, Socialism and Religion. Because one of the questions I'm asking in the book is the post-secular some sort of new phenomenon? Or is it a sort of post-secularism merely a sort of the latest form of a recurring element in modern secularism? This desire to, in a sense, regain some of the sort of heritage of the religious in the context of a secular society. So therefore, this partly accounts for why it's essentially there's a sort of strong historical dimension in the work. It's looking back to a period in interwar Britain when a number of philosophers and writers began to explore the ways in which a sort of religion could be an important dimension of a progressive politics. And so I look at them individually, which I'll say who they are in a moment to do, and then I look at the way they interact in a political party which was established in the Second World War called Commonwealth, hence the title. So it looks at, it's trying to look at sort of broader issues of sort of the modern sort of post-secular debates. It's looking at a number of individual writers who I argue have interesting things to say, and I'm looking at a sort of specific, if you like, an interesting historical phenomenon, this political party in the Second World War.
Very good. So I'm curious to know, first of all, a little bit about Commonwealth, the party. I think there's kind of two bookends to this project, as I see it. On the one hand, you have the emergence, really, of the sort of powerful communist movement in the form of the Soviet Union in the early 1930s. Uh-huh. That kind of sets off all of this thought. And then the kind of the culmination in terms of organization and actual impact seems to be actually during the war, 40 to 45, yes. The emergence of this party. So maybe you could say something about these four thinkers that you've, you know, taken up in those two bookends.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are four people I look at. The first one is John McMurray, who is a philosopher. And this particular chapter is concerned with his work on Marx in the 1930s. Marx appealed to McMurray because there seemed to be... McMurray was a very anti-dualist, if we can come back to, and found in Marx a very valuable resource for developing the sorts of ideas which predated his encounter with Marx. So, and the general point is the notion of the relationship between, if you like, radical thought and Christianity, in the case of McMurray, their relationship, which remains to this day a sort of fraught topic. The second chapter is by a chap called Kenneth Ingram. And he's a writer, writes novels. And my focus on him is himself as a sexual theorist. Particularly his person who is gay, and he's attempting to understand and sort of like ground homosexuality, or at least sort of make homosexuality in some ways compatible with Christianity. What makes him, if like a very edgy character, what makes it made it a difficult chapter to write, is that along with a number of homosexual writers and homosexuals in the 1930s, there is, if you won't call a pederastic dimension to his work, an attempt to validate the notion of boy love, as it's called, And to this day, there is this moment, there is still this notion of how, if you like, what the relationship between homosexuality and Christianity is. To what extent can homosexuality be compatible with, in accordance with, and so forth, Christianity? So again, there's a sort of a contemporary relevance to that. The third chapter is about the science fiction writer and philosopher Ola Stapleton, the author of, people may know his book Star Maker, the 1930s. Here, in a sense, the discussion goes to his sort of cosmological speculations, the notion of the how societies destroy themselves, how civilizations destroy themselves, and his attempt to develop, if you like, a religious analysis of this process. The difference between himself and McMurray and Ingram is that where they are explicitly Christian, Stapleton is not merely not Christian, but is very critical of Christianity. So his is sort of like a religious but non-Christian perspective to that. The fourth chapter is about somebody who, in a sense, is not a philosopher, and although wrote pamphlets, isn't really a sort of, in a strong sense, a writer, but a politician, a liberal politician. He's included because it was he who set up this party, Commonwealth, in the Second World War. And Commonwealth was established in the context of, like, the suspension of domestic politics during the Second World War, in that you had a coalition of the main parties and there were no contested elections. And Commonwealth inserted itself in the space created by that, by contesting by-elections, but also issued a very radical social and economic plan about common ownership of all the major elements of society, industry, and so forth. So it's a very radical programme. Now, the linkage between, if like, Ackland, Richard Ackland, the person in question, and the other three, that all the three of them, those three became members of the Commonwealth Party. And so I explore their sort of role in the Commonwealth Party, but also because Commonwealth then became, if like, convulsed, certainly at the leadership level, by a whole series of battles, intellectual battles, about the role of religion in the party. And you had a sort of very complicated series of positions where McMurray, Ingram and Stapleton took a variety of positions, usually against Ackland. And also you got in Commonwealth a number of other positions from very orthodox Christian to sort of Marxists who'd sort of abandoned or had been thrown out of the Communist Party, particularly two characters, Tom Wintringham and his wife Kitty Bowler, who are very hostile to any talk of religion, any talk of morality. And so throughout this sort of brief existence of the party, you get this very complex, very rich debate about the role of religion in modern society. The party itself, it was basically destroyed by the collapse of the coalition, the party coalition at the end of the war. Once the Labour Party rejoined electoral politics, Commonwealth, which to some extent was occupying the space vacated by the Labour Party, was squeezed out. And the party, although it didn't actually sort of collapse, all the main people, apart from Stapleton, left the party, and the party limped on well into, you know, sort of, I think, into the 1980s, but a sort of fragmentary, very tiny party by that stage. So broadly, it's the sort of architecture of the piece.
Yeah, excellent, excellent. I wanted to start off talking about the McMurray character, because you begin the book really with McMurray, and there's good reason, because he seems to be the one who has the deepest engagement with Marxism, and it's the core question of the book, obviously, the relationship of Christianity and Marxism. And there's some very interesting statements by McMurray where he says that I'm a Christian because I'm not in the church, and I'm not in the church because I'm a Christian. Or this notion that to be a Christian means to not be a Christian, uh-huh, in a certain sense in this time period. And it has to do with his particular reading of the historical importance of the Russian Revolution, of the Soviet communism, together with the intellectual legacy of Marx, right, and of German idealism. So there's those two things that he seems to be grappling with that are helping him to move to a new Christian position, a critique of Christianity through Marxism. So first I have a question about that. What is he learning from Marx that is going to, let's say, critique Christianity?
Okay. Well, that's going back one step further. McMurray, if you like, is educated at a time in philosophy where you have, in many ways, a sort of dominance of what's often called British idealism, which is a form of, sort of British Hegelianism. And this British idealism, it's very powerful, particularly in Scotland, where McMurray was an undergraduate at Glasgow University, and also at Balliol College, Oxford, where he then eventually became sort of was a student and also became a sort of lecturer there. And British idealism is very anti-dualist, I suppose, which is something you would know about, Todd, in that, you know, I know you've sort of worked on monism. And there's a degree to which this sort of tradition is monist. It doesn't like... It likes a notion. It wants a notion of, if you like, there is a sort of a process in history, which it encompasses everything, if you like. So now, Murray, to some extent, rejects elements of the idealist tradition, because in the post-war Britain, after the First World War, you get a sort of a move towards realism, a dislike of metaphysics, and so forth. So that McMurray is trying to develop sort of a new approach, but it's clearly marked by this British idealist tradition. So in a sense, he's looking for ways, if you like, to theoretically develop his anti-dualism. And in the context of the time, in the 1930s, clearly, one of the sort of major modern political intellectual influences is Marxism. And therefore, he begins to study Marxism and begins to find, particularly in the early Marx, a similar dislike of dualism in the early Marx. He's enabled to do this, in a sense, because he's one of, I think he's probably the first person writing in English to be acquainted with the newly published Economic and Philosophical Manuscripts of 1844. These had come out in German in 1932. And assisted by the Hungarian socialist Karl Polanyi, McMurray worked through these texts. And he found in the Economic and Philosophical Manuscripts, and in some of Marx's previously published texts, notably on the Jewish question, that Marx was sort of fiercely anti-dualist, and that from that, McMurray began to look back, if you like, prior to Marx, people Marx had interacted with, and understood the influence of Feuerbach in all of this 19th century German philosopher, and began to understand that Marx's social theory grew out of essentially a critique of religion, and that therefore that Marx's conception of alienation, political alienation, economic alienation, and ideology, in a sense, were developments of this engagement with the Feuerbachian critique of dualism. And it was this that, if you like, provided a sort of intellectual framework for McMurray's attempt to develop an account of the development of Christianity in the modern world, which argue that there was a Christian basis for the Enlightenment, and that there was a sort of like an Enlightenment, that the Enlightenment itself then developed as sort of like a Christian dimension. So in the latter case, there is a notion, therefore, that things which seem to be sort of anathema to Christianity, hostile to it, such as, say, modern science, revolutionary political movements, including Marxism, including the sort of the Soviet Bolsheviks, that in some way these, what appeared to be ultra anti-Christian, were in some sense the development of this dimension, this, if you like, authentic dimension in Christianity, where something which seemed to be fundamentally anti-Christian was paradoxically the actual, in the modern world, a highly authentic development of Christianity, and that it was, if you like, the opponents, the so-called Christians, who were, if you like, anti-Christian in their sense. So, in a sense, this is, if like, the basis of then the project of McMurray in the 1930s.
Well, that was excellent. What's interesting, though, is I think from the point of view of, say, Feuerbach or even early Marx, really the history of Christianity is really a history of humanism that's worked through the Christian stages to come to an understanding of itself as a self-conscious humanity. So, but what seems quite interesting about all of these characters is that they seem to want to then, from the humanism, get back to the Christianity. And there's a very interesting pamphlet or book by Acklin that you mentioned, which is called It Must Be Christianity, or I think that's the name of it, from 1941, I think, where he suggests that the humanists and Christians are going to be able to unite in the party of Commonwealth, but also in the project of, liberating humanity, making the next step forward in human civilization. But from the point of view of these Christian Marxists, it seems that ultimately humanism itself is going to be re-Christianized. And is there something to that, am I misreading it?
In the case of Acklin, his point is that he's different from the other three thinkers I discuss, in that he is your classic dualist, in a sense, in that Acklin undergoes a conversion experience in the early 40s, 1940s, and develops what is, in a sense, a fairly, well, not entirely orthodox, but theologically fairly orthodox Anglicanism, or Episcopalianism, as it would be known in the United States. So he does talk about the relationship between humanism and Christianity, but in a sense, he has a sort of hegemonic project of his own, which is basically humanists or Christians who don't quite realise it yet.
Right.
But Christians, in a sense, not in the sort of McMurray Ingram sense, but humanists in the sense that they're basically can be won over to, in Acklin's case, to a fairly orthodox, dualistic Christianity. So Acklin then becomes, within Commonwealth, a bit of an outrider, and trying to defend the fairly orthodox Christianity against Ingram and McMurray's notion of a Christianity in which there is no God, isn't in an external figure, isn't a personal God, cannot be appealed to, that God is in some sense a process of human development. So from that, McMurray and Ingram are in a sense sort of from a very different perspective vis-a-vis this. So the terms, although they often use the similar terms, they're actually coming from very different positions, original positions.
For McMurray then, it does seem that even though he has this imminent notion of Christianity, of the divine, which in some sense is compatible in his understanding with socialism, with Marxism, it seems nonetheless that he expects Christianity to come back, as it were, and provide a new element in the unfolding of the dialectic, so that in a sense there's a approval of Soviet communism in a general sense, but there's also a hidden, or maybe not hidden, there's a critique from a Christian perspective, where it seems that they anticipate a sort of renegotiation of the religion of Christianity and Marxism, also potentially in the Soviet Union. Is that correct?
Yes. His writing on this occasion is sort of rather messy and not always consistent. He sees the sort of Russian Bolsheviks as, in a sense, more Christian than the sort of Christians, because, in a sense, they are... their attack on religion is, in a sense, a sort of a premonition or a foretaste of a notion where you don't have separate religions. You know, McMurray says, doesn't he, at some point, a society which has religions isn't religious. So the fact that the Bolsheviks are, in a sense, anti-religious is to him, in one sense, a sign that they are, if you like, being the Christians of the modern era. And it is those who see Christianity as a faith, with a dualistic Christianity, or the people who have gone down the wrong path, in a sense. But he's aware that, if you like, the radical atheism in the Soviet Union can, in a sense, be so pervasive as to undermine the whole notion of there being a value to religion, and that it can be sort of decline into a sort of visionless, ungrounded totalitarianism, in a sense. So he wants this sort of delicate balancing act that somehow communism is this sort of political, is politically important, but on the other hand is aware that there are sort of problems with this. And as you said, you use the word dialectical, because that's what he does. The main text is his book A Clue to History, which he wrote in the 1930s, which is an extraordinarily sort of dense account of the sort of tortuous dialectic of European history back to a sort of Hebrew civilization, where all the time he's trying to show, what appears to be the most hostile to Christianity is, in fact, the authentic development of it. And you have these sorts of... and he uses a sort of notion of a dialectic to try and give some sort of theoretical basis for what appears sort of counterintuitive in the first case. It's not entirely successful, but I think that's what he's trying to do there vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. And he's clearly there's a degree of credulity in his approach to the Soviet Union, but I don't think it's duplicity. In other words, it's not somebody who actually basically knows this is the deception here, but he's prepared all the time to give the Bolsheviks a sort of the benefit of the doubt in this respect. So he does talk about the selfless leadership in the Soviet Union, and all of the people I look at, to some extent, and particularly once the sort of Soviet Union joined the Allies in the Second World War, there is an attempt to, if you like, see the Soviet Union in the best possible light, in that sense. I think that's...
Just picking up on this, the question of the anti-dualism of McMurray, we already mentioned the word monism, and as you also said, I'm very interested in this particular topic for my own research. But something that strikes me about the monism of this group of intellectuals you're looking at is that they're carrying forward certain intellectual projects from the 19th century that we see coming from other directions, out of the natural sciences, from characters like Ernst Haeckel, who was this interpreter of Darwin, who came up with a monistic account, really, of human evolution using Darwin and kind of adhering to it, a worldview that was going to be anti-dualistic. So uh-huh. Everything was going to be explained from a single principle of mechanistic science plus Darwinian evolution. And in the 20s, it seems that one of the effects, almost philosophically, of the Russian Revolution, and especially once the Soviet Union becomes a real, you know, force in its own, through its own development in the five-year plans in the early 1930s, is that that it seems that on a philosophical religious level, a whole new group of intellectuals start to grapple with this question of dualism in philosophy, and we start to see both embracing of monism by certain people, such as what you're looking at, and we see others that develop a critique of communism using the same principles almost. So you have people like Erich Fröcklin, who had developed the theory of political theology in the 1930s. There are other, especially Catholic intellectuals from Central Europe that were involved in this struggle against communism. And they interpreted communism in religious terms. You know, on one level as the Antichrist. Many of these Protestant and Catholic theologians in Germany and Austria. But some of them, like Fröcklin, developed this notion that it was a type of religious heresy. Fröcklin, in this essay on political religions, described it as immanentizing the eschaton. So the eschatological elements of Western Christianity were being made imminent. They were being brought down into history, mm-hmm. and that communists were essentially a type of a heretical movement, perhaps out of Christianity, but had taken the wrong path and were embracing this notion that you could have, in a sense, the kingdom of Christ, the kingdom of God on this earth, right? That it was an imminent fulfillment mm-hmm. of sacred history. And so this was the criticism by the Fröcklin and other, you know, conservative theologians in Central Europe. So it was almost the mirror image of what McMurray was doing, because, you know, they were saying, well, this is a horrible heresy, mm-hmm. you know, to be trying to pursue sacred history in time, in you know, secular history, mm-hmm. whereas McMurray seemed to embrace embrace that element. There's not exactly a question in that, but something else. You mention also some other figures that are, you know, you bring up on the sort of side, such as like Ernst Bloch. You mentioned it was one of your earlier books you've written on him. I'm thinking also of Walter Benjamin. It seems to me these are other philosophical minds of that time period that are encountering Soviet communism and responding.
Yes.
I'm just curious.
I mean, I draw attention to Bloch in the book because there does seem to be sort of a great deal of sort of similarities, particularly McMurray and Bloch, in that Bloch also understands the critiques for Feuerbach, but talks about, if you like, I think he calls it as a sacred line leading from Feuerbach via sort of Marx and so forth, rather Hegel, Feuerbach, Marx. And there is an appreciation in Bloch of the importance of Feuerbach to the emergence of Marxism. And in the book I contrast, if you like, Bloch, McMurray's reading of Marx, where, if you like, what else was available in English in the 1930s. So I look at Isaiah Berlin's biography of Marx and E.H. Carr's biography. And they really don't appreciate the importance of Feuerbach and this whole Marx's engagement with religion in the development of his thought. And Berlin calls Feuerbach a sort of charlatan, I think, or something like that at some point. And when McMurray's work was published, you've got people who, reviewing his work, saying, you know, McMurray doesn't understand Marx. What's all this stuff about sort of religion and so forth in it? So there was a review of one of his works called Does McMurray Understand Marx? Where the answer was in the negative. There's all these sort of manuscripts which had sort of appeared. You know, you should really look at these important texts, and that these were just sort of, you know, sort of tryouts and so forth. So anyway, Murray is very much ahead of his time. I mean, there were people like Marcuse himself brought out a review of the economic and philosophical manuscripts in 1932. So there was appreciation of that, and Polanyi helped McMurray sort of to sort of read through these works and so forth. So so McMurray's sort of working through of the sort of the anti-dualism dimension in Marx is very prescient for its time, I would say.
Mm-hmm. And this notion of the immanentization of the theological content of Christianity, I'm just curious about how does it remain Christian, or what is the you keep referring to the fact that they saw themselves as Christians. Is it merely in the origin of this development in history that they see themselves as Christians, or do they actually adhere to the notion of some kind of salvations, or to what degree are they really Christian? Or
good question. One problem is that, particularly in the case of McMurray, and also to suppose to Ingram, who's very influenced by McMurray, it's not clear what they mean by God, even in their work, because they are sort of immanentists. They use metaphors and so forth, and there's a very sort of lot of sort of negativism, you know, in the sense that they say, well, God isn't this. God doesn't exist in another realm. God is not a sort of person, in a sense. God is not someone who you can appeal to. God is, in some sense, part of the process. But they see, specifically in the question of why then do they call themselves Christian? Yes, particularly in the case of McMurray, it's because he sees the figure of Jesus as a pivotal figure in the transmission of the virtues and the values of ancient Hebrew society. And ancient Hebrew society for McMurray features a sort of mixture of, sort of golden age, geist, telos all in one. But Hebrew society, in a sense, is a sort of almost a sort of anticipation of the dimensions of a future sort of like good society. In the Hebrew society in McMurray's reading is one where is itself fundamentally anti-dualist. So, for example, he points to the fact that they resisted the attempt to establish kingship against the political dualism. He saw the prophet's attack on the priestly class, again, anti-dualist in his conception, and the fact that, you know, property redistribution via the sort of jubilee. And that, according to McMurray, ancient Hebrew society, there wasn't, again, a division of labour where there was one thing called religion and other dimensions. The whole society was, in a sense, sort of religious. So that it was a religious society, but there was no religion as such. Now, the figure of Jesus for McMurray is the person who, in a sense, appreciated that dimension. This was, as if like, the values of the society in which he grew up. But the fact that, if you like, the priestly caste in Jewish society, because they rejected Jesus, is McMurray's notion that somehow this is the point when Hebrew society begins to, sort of like, unwind. And this, therefore, is the moment where, if you like, the sort of Jesus message begins to move from, if you like, merely a expression of a sort of local society, begins to become universal in that sense via the sort of Roman Empire and therefore into Europe and so forth. So, although in one sense it's talking about the virtues of a Jewish society, in McMurray's notion it only becomes universal once it sort of morphs into Christianity. At that point, Christianity then becomes, if you like, the bearer of the heritage of Jesus and his reflections upon the virtues of Hebrew society. So in that sense, that's why McMurray can still call himself, he says, Christian, because that there is this sort of reference back to Jesus. There's no, within McMurray though, there's no, and that's why he says, he's a Christian outside the Christian churches, because the notion of separate churches is a sign in the sense that things have gone badly wrong. Once religion becomes a separate notion of a faith with institutions and doctrines and so forth, then that indicates that the society is fragmented, that you're beginning to get a sort of debilitating division of labour based upon social inequality, economic inequality, and so forth. So it's that. But of course, to critics, it was not at all clear, therefore, why McMurray or Ingram were actually Christians in that sense, because they seemed to be rejecting everything which was sort of salient to Christianity, namely that Jesus was God and that the God was a sort of external being. So that it mystified many of their critics, that it seemed to them some sort of rather weird heresy McMurray and Ingram were engaged in. And once Commonwealth was started, Ackland got into trouble with some of the really conservative Christians in the organisation for being seen to associate, particularly with Ingram's work, because this sort of very conservative Christian felt, well, why are you, Ackland, why are you associating with something which is a sort of modernist heresy? So the sort of notion of them being called Christians was by no means, unproblematic, and was a factor in, if you like, some of the political and theoretical debates within Commonwealth about the role of the religion in the party.
Excellent. I wanted to turn to the second subject of this study, which was Kenneth Ingram, and there was a nice quotation in your book where McMurray is reflecting in later years upon a meeting of the early 1930s. I think perhaps at his college. I'm not sure where it took place. But at any rate, he said that there were two burning issues of today. One was communism, and the other was sexuality.
That's right.
And he obviously decided to focus on communism. And in a sense, Ingram focused on sexuality.
That's right.
And I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about Ingram, and what I'm particularly interested in is the particular, let's say, the utopian content of his vision of homosexuality, because you mentioned its problematic aspects, in retrospect, the focus on boy love. But there's also a utopian element to this way that he conceives of boy love, or of the role of homosexuality in human development in this time period.
Yeah, I mean, you need to distinguish. I mean, he's trying to validate homosexuality sort of generally and essentially in terms of adults, but there is this dimension to his work, there's the boy-love dimension. It's an important element to his work, but theoretically you can see he's of interest in terms of the way he attempts to sort of theorise homosexuality and tries to argue that in some sense this is compatible with Christianity as he understands it. I mean, he starts out with a sort of a notion which essentially he gets from Carpenter, who really gets it from Magnus Hirschfeld, the notion that homosexuality is some sort of third sex. His development on it, though, and this in a sense comes back where the sort of boil up dimension comes into it, is he does what many sort of homosexuals of the time do, is to look back to ancient Greece and to argue that, if you like, the strength of Greek society came from, if you like, this sort of homosocial, homosexual bonding of males in it. And that this sort of love of comrades, to use Carpenter's term, actually was a very sort of creative dimension. And so in his early work, in Ingram's early work, there is this notion that somehow this dimension of love between men can help to inform and help develop a better society. So he does develop what he calls a sort of utopia, with some rather odd notions in it. Part of it, and one of the sort of darker dimensions in his work, there's a sort of misogyny in it. Part of this focus on sort of the homosocial, on the homosexual, means that sort of women, he doesn't really successfully or adequately apply as much thought to the role of women. You know, this his focus all the time is on the homosocial spaces and interests. So he talks about, in his utopia, there is a house of ladies, equivalent to the House of Lords, which votes on women's issues, as he sees it. And he talks about the independence of women from men, but so that men actually can spend more time with each other, in a sense. So in this early stuff, there's a lot of this sort of Victorian Hellenism with a sort of homosexual dimension. A sort of feudal socialism, I would say, the way I put it, where there are sort of dukes and things like that. It's also linked with, it comes out of, a lot of these themes are out of Anglo-Catholicism, which is a very high church form of Protestantism. And Ingram, in this, from like tens and twenties particularly, is very much a sort of an advocate of a sort of Anglo-Catholicism. But so there is this sort of, there's an attempt to sort of theorise in terms of Carpenter's concepts. There's an attempt to try and argue the virtue, if you like, of these relations of affection and so forth. But this does rule out any sexual activity between men. In other words, he accepts that in this that Christianity, which he is clearly a Christian at this stage, rules out any form of sexual activity outside marriage. So these, if you like, relations between men are non-sexual. Similarly, sort of the notion of sort of boy love, again, it's not in any way an attempt to validate that at the sexual level. So you get this as a sort of, if you like to say, his starting point. And then there's a sort of intermediate period, which we won't go into. But in the 1930s, he begins to become influenced by McMurray's work on Christianity and so forth. And at the same time, he begins to refine his notion of what homosexuality is, away from the sort of third sex notion, away from the idea of sexuality, some sort of sexual presence in the individual, that one is homosexual because of certain inbuilt ontological features, towards the notion that homosexuality is is determined by the choice of your sexual partner, and that therefore it's a much more fluid field of forces. Now, equipped with sort of McMurray's notions, he begins to do a sort of hermeneutics of the Bible. It's to see at this stage, and this is by now we're talking about the late 1930s, beginning of the 1940s, how a reading of the Bible, a sort of deep reading as McMurray had done, could provide a sort of new basis for saying that sort of homosexuality was valid, but also sexuality was valid. And he develops this notion that the basics of Christian ethics is love, and that is the basis of things. So if two people love one another, then that is, if you like, the Christian response. Whereas, if you like, the sort of morality he previously held to, he sees as a sort of anti-Christian legalism, which had crept into Christianity, whereby Christianity is a series of, you know, thou shalt not do this, do that, and that homosexuality was one of the dimensions, which was do not do this. So by the end, by the late 1930s, he's developing this notion of an ethical base for homosexual sexual behaviour. But this then presents him with a headache, which he never entirely resolved with, if that's the case, at what age is this legitimate? And there are hints in the work that he does end up with something, that he really does feel that there has to be some age of consent, which seems to be, in his mind, 16. And so forth, there are sort of hints of that. So he moves, I say there is a move away from this Anglo-Catholic, and also within the Anglo-Catholic period, not only is there misogyny, but there's a rather sort of obvious dimension of anti-Semitism in the work. Again, that largely goes with the interaction with McMurray. The other debt to McMurray, not simply the sort of the notion of a hermeneutic, hermeneutics of the Bible texts, is the notion of friendship or the personal in McMurray. McMurray's notion of the way he tried to conceptualize, like the utopian core of his work, is the notion of friendship, that people can relate to one another as individuals, in a sense, a question of love between individuals, non-exploitative relationships. And he uses the term friendship. Now, friendship in the sort of homosexual community was often a code word for homosexual behaviour. I'm using homosexual behaviour rather than gay here throughout this, isn't it? In terms of the historical project, these are the terms that he uses, in a sense. I'm gay myself, so I would describe myself as gay. But when you're sort of doing the historical analysis, to use the term gay in that, it's difficult to do it with the texts and so forth. So using the terms that Ingram uses, which is homosexual and sometimes invert, he sees in McMurray a notion which implies, you know, that if you like, a sort of what are good human relationships are ones where mutuality and so forth, where it's not a matter of gender and so forth, but between, if you like, person to person. So that's another element he gets out of McMurray and why he's sort of attracted to McMurray's work.
Very good. I think we might leave the two other thinkers for those who are going to read the book. But I do want to talk about the sort of, the contemporary context and relevance of this study, because, we always, at least historians, we're always in some sense writing a history of the present, right? We always have our present concerns that lead us to our historical questions. And, you've taken up a phenomenon that's quite fascinating, because it really opens a window on this period, certainly 1930 to 1945 and probably before and after as well. It's interesting also because it's a movement that, essentially was... It wasn't stillborn, but I mean, the party didn't really survive, as you said, the re-entry of labor into British politics at the end of the war. And I find it fascinating to think about both about, what are the contemporary relevance of these movements that have been lost to sort of recover their intellectual work, but then also to think about, what they say about that specific period precisely because they didn't survive, in mm-hmm. a sense. So those are sort of two things that interest me, at thinking about these figures today. Could you say a little bit more? You mentioned at the beginning this whole question of the post-secular.
Uh-huh.
I think that deserves to be unpacked a bit. One historical period ends in 1945. The appeal in a very broad sense of the Soviet Union perhaps ends around the beginning of the Cold War. But certainly after 1989, Marxism as a whole suffers. What does the term post-secular mean? And how does it fit into this post-Cold War period.
Well, the post-secular, the term post-secular is itself contested to some extent. There are different meanings of it. There are two very diametrically opposite versions of it. There's one which is, if you like, a conservative approach, which by post-secular means pre-secular. In other words, the term is used to describe an attack on the elements of secularism. So it's anti-liberal, anti-socialist, belief that the whole secular move was a terrible mistake. Separation of church and state, all these dimensions were an appalling error. So it's sometimes used by conservative, anti-secular writers. The way that I use it and the way which many others use it is the notion that the secular moment historically was important. In other words, that these things like the emergence of liberalism and modernity were important and need to be defended. But the feeling that sort of post-secular is feeling that one of the prices paid for that is that there was a devaluation of the heritage of the religious, that it was seen as, so like someone like Richard Rorty was the one who was an example of that. He said, you know, that secularism was a sort of the Enlightenment's deal with religion, that religion just becomes a private affair, and is best not used in sort of the public domain, in a sense. The perspective sense is there some way in which, if like the heritage of religion can be utilized today, but in the context where there is a defense of the achievements of modernity. Now, two dimensions to that. One is, well, that there's value in that because, in a way, the religious tradition can provide resources, which is sometimes lacking in secular discourse. In other words, the notion of soul is a much more capacious and resonant notion than the notion, say, of the individual or something like that. In other words, there's been a whole series of levels of meaning that have lost, to some extent, in secular vocabulary. And that this vocabulary, the religious vocabulary, can provide like a richer basis for engaging with people who are of faith. So, for example, part of the argument is that, in a sense, when a secular person is confronted by a religious person with a piece of scripture, there's simply no meeting of minds. In a way, from the secular point of view, this is a substance, simple nonsense. And therefore, there's no actual positive engagement there. Yeah. The man is just talking nonsense, the woman's just talking nonsense from that perspective, which is a sort of, to some extent, a sort of Rorty perspective. And so there's no meeting of minds. And therefore, in a sense, if there is an attempt to understand and appreciate the religious dimension, there is a basis for dialogue there. But there's also, I think, particularly in the wake of 9/11, which in a sense gave us stimulus to the notion of post-secularism, where now you had what was seen as a religious, political project of a very sort of destructive nature. The post-secular approach also enables perhaps a way to contest that, not simply saying in traditional secular liberal terms, well, this is awful, but to actually say, well, why are people doing this? And to engage both, you know, with their own, you know, sort of religious texts and with people in that community who one can have dialogue with on the basis that there is an understanding there. And there is the beginnings of within some sort of, particularly within Islam, are people using the term post-secular also there. The notion that the Quran can be used as a in the context of a sort of modern society with sort of liberal principles and so forth. And in a sense, to go back to the authors, you know, they are doing similar sorts of things. So in the sense that, like Stapleton argues, that deliberately use you know, term religious terms, arguing, and his characters do in his novels. And the argument there is, you know, why should concepts which are the heritage of all humanity merely be seen as the property of people with faith, in a sense? So all four thinkers, in a sense, are of the mind that religion is too important to be left to the religious. That here's an area of, if you like, the whole of human development, human creation, and that therefore, you know, the narrowly religious should not be seen to have a monopoly and a veto on these terms, nor is it therefore inadmissible or bizarre for people who may not be members of faith communities to use religious texts and so forth in varying degrees. In other words, there are post-secular writers who I would, you know, sort of identify who, I mean, this ranges from sort of atheists right through to believers. I mean, in some respects you might call, though he might disagree, Charles Taylor, his book, you know, the Secular Age, came out a few years ago. I mean, there are parallels between what he's doing and what, say, McMurray's doing in McMurray's A Clue to History, in that Taylor is at pains to argue that the modern world isn't what he calls, it's not a subtraction theory. Namely, that what the story is, you once had an age of faith and then people sort of abandoned it. And that's the history of the secular world. Rather, he wants to show, as McMurray wants to show, that actually this sort of secular culture grew out of and was actually developed by religious people, in a sense, that they developed the concepts. And that therefore there is an authentic, if you like, likewise, sort of religious dimension there. And likewise, Taylor says, you know, although we want secularism, you know, in the sense that someone like Rorty might have in mind that, although we want secularism, this cannot be at the expense of what he says it is a spiritual lobotomy, that you just can't sweep away this rich tradition, which has this, you know, in many ways, from his perspective, a religious base. So for someone like Taylor, the Reformation, although he's a Roman Catholic, the Reformation was necessary and was valuable. That, in a sense, Luther is part of this a sort of element of renewal in the Reformation and is developing out of religious categories, things which begin to develop into what we would see as, you know, liberal notions like tolerance, like ultimately division of church and state and so forth. These things grow out of, you know, religious discourse, and I guess people like Locke and so forth. So that you know, this term post-secular seems to sort of evoke a variety of different projects and approaches. The one that seems to me to have sort of richness, but as I said at the very beginning, that sometimes people seem to argue that this is a sort of a unique historical moment, that we are entering the age of post-secularism. When I want to argue, well, I argue in the book to some extent, argued elsewhere, that it's more a case of post-secularism is the latest in, what seems to be a recurring recognition since, you know, the sort of the development of secularism. So, for example, Carlyle, you know, talks about there were two half men, David Hume with his science, and Dr. Johnson with a sort of deep sort of religious theme element in it. He said, what we want is a complete man, somebody who's actually sort of attuned to science, but nonetheless is aware of the sort of religious. So that goes back to sort of the 19th century. And it seems to me the moment of Commonwealth is one of these, from the thinkers which sort of, you know, debated within this political party, an earlier form, is a sort of earlier form of these concerns manifesting themselves.
I was just thinking also about the, I think you've done a great job of really explaining, as you said, continuities in this thinking about, or complicated thinking about the relationship of the secular and the sacred or the religious, and the ways in which these thinkers are engaged in a conversation that is, in a sense, continued recently in philosophy and in critical theory in general. But I'm also struck by the fact that it seems that there's something quite different about their approach, which is that they are they're not post-secular in the sense that they are they're still very modernist. They're not post-modernist. They actually want to, at least with McMurray, it strikes me anyway, that he wants to have still the telos in the history, yeah. And he wants the resolution of these dynamic terms so that the secular and the sacred are engaged in this dialectical operation, whereas it seems to me, and I'm not very, very well read in this literature, but with somebody like Habermas, Jürgen Habermas, that when he talks about the post-secular, he really is talking about a dialogue between the religious and the secular without a resolution. It's merely keeping the channels of communication open. As far as, you know, this may be a complete simplification, but the post-secular doesn't want to reduce one term to the other, the religious and the secular, but rather maintain the kind of contradictions in the aporia. And is this?
Well, yeah. I mean, as a historian, you have to recognize that when you say things recur, they never recur in exactly the same way. In a word, that the position in the 19 beginning of this century meant that you know the terrain of thinking was different to what it is today. So I'm not saying that you can read off all current concerns of people like Habermas and Taylor and find them. Yeah. But in a sense, there is, if you like, a similar sense of unease in both of them, that there is something not right about the relationship between the notion of religious and secular. Now, the way they then work through that is different and will reflect, you know, the intellectual and social and political and cultural context of the time. So you're not going to find, you know, Habermas's necessarily in the 1920s and so forth. But nonetheless, I think what it points to is a recurring sense that the arrangement or the development of the relationship between religious and secular needs to be refined and renegotiated. And that wherever this happens historically, then, you know, it uses the intellectual context of the time, the debates, to try and work through this unease in ways which make sense in the sort of intellectual milieu of the time. And therefore, clearly, from a historical perspective, these people, yeah, I don't call them post-secularists. I simply say that they are part of this, like the tensions within the sort of relationship between the religious and the secular, which generates, you know, this unease and leads to attempt to try and renegotiate by sort of finding the sort of ways to which perhaps the sort of heritage of religion can be sort of positively sort of integrated. But the particular form of take will vary depending when. Post-secularism is the term. In that sense, it's a product of this time. So you don't find the term used. I think the earliest usage is about 1972, and there are a few, two or three usages in the 80s and 90s. But in its current form, it is, as the term has become more widespread, then it is becoming very much a concept of the struggles and the of the time. So in that sense, it's unique, but it's not as a sort of moment. It's not unique in that sense. In other words, it is part of this sort of post-medieval emergence of the secular, and you know the ways in which people felt that that in its particular form isn't entirely working, and that needs therefore you know renegotiations.
I was wondering if we might end on a note with which you begin your book, or at the first chapter, I think, which is a comment by Tony Blair that he took inspiration from John McMurray and referred people back to the book. Just as a sort of figure at the end of the 20th century of great importance in British politics and labor, it's just an interesting moment, you know, where the Christian and the Marxist, if you so will, where they come together in Tony Blair and maybe where they go apart again. Any final thoughts on that?
I'm like many people, I'm sceptical of to what extent Blair was familiar with McMurray's work. I mean, there's little to see in Blair's you know, attenuated social democracy and sort of neoliberalism, much that would appeal to McMurray. I mean, clearly the Blair is Christian, in that sense, that's an element in it, but people, when they heard about that Blair was talking about McMurray, and many people in their mind had this vision, therefore McMurray must be some sort of 1930s pious social democrat. And as you know, we've seen, he's not. He's a sort of very radical thinker, a Marxist, who actually does want the establishment of the kingdom of heaven on earth. That is what he's after. Language you wouldn't hear in Tony Blair. So the Blair, though, did McMurray a service, in that certainly by the time of his death in the 1970s, McMurray was philosophically dreadfully old hat, and people like A.J. Eyre, who succeeded him at University College London, was derisory about him in his memoir, and didn't thank him in his inaugural, as you're supposed to do. So he was very much a sort of forgotten figure in the 70s and 80s. And in a sense, Blair's mentioning of him, then people said, well, who is this John McMurray? And that, to some extent, stimulated a sort of a new interest in McMurray. But once the people who then read McMurray then scratched their heads as to what it could be that you know Blair had taken from this. And Blair doesn't actually spell it out particularly, what it is. He just says, read McMurray and you'll find what I'm about. Well, people have done up to Blair and McMurray, not entirely clear yet, or if ever, what this, you know, what the relationship is.
Very good. Well, Vince, I think we've taken enough of your time today. I want to thank you very much for this fascinating interview and a very interesting book, and wish you all the best.
Great. Thanks, Todd. Appreciate it.
Okay, thanks for being on the show.
Okay, thanks. Bye.